listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything. Well, guys, if you like fantasy football, it is back, and DraftKings.com is celebrating with millions. That's right, I said millions in cash prizes. DraftKings, one-day games mean you never get locked into a season, okay? It's a one-day fantasy sports thing. It's like a new season every time you play. So pick your team in minutes, and you can instantly, and I mean instantly, be getting your share of the $1 million they're awarding kickoff week. Yeah, I said it. Week one, this football season, $1 million is up for grabs. DraftKings is where anyone, and I mean anyone, can enter with a couple bucks and win big cash prizes. True story, one guy won $100,000 his very first time. $100,000 day one. So play for free. Yeah, free. At DraftKings.com, enter Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, with your first pay game and get free entry, I love free, into the $1 million kickoff bash. Seriously, free entry. That could win you thousands just playing fantasy football. Use Callen, my name, C-A-L-L-E-N, at DraftKings.com. Let me say it one more time, DraftKings.com. But only if you like football and if you're an American, which I am. Okay. All right, everybody, this is the Brian Callen Show, and I'm Brian Callen with my sidekick, Hunter Motz. Is that music I'm hearing in the background? I like it. I don't care what it is. It doesn't matter. We're not a polished
That's the death program. Drone of the death cult of...
Oh, is that the... what is that? That sounds like a vibrator upstairs. I want it. I want it on the podcast. I think it's good. It's fine. It doesn't matter because we've got a man who's used to all kinds of craziness and all kinds of chaos and things not working and trains not running on time. Bob Harris. Bob Harris, ladies and gentlemen. Author of The International Bank of Bob, Prisoner of Trebekistan, and a bunch of other stuff. And by the way, voiceover artist, TV writer, and actor. A man of many talents, the composite man, as it were. And again, that is a vacuum. That's a vacuum cleaner in the background. I love it. I want to keep the vacuum cleaner in the background. Bob, welcome. Welcome to the BCS, the Brian Callen Show.
Brian, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's very cool. And may I add, I've been a fan of yours for years. I remember your Mad TV work. I see you coming across my television screen at unexpected moments. We are both highly familiar with what it is to try to make a living.
Yes, sir. Yes, yes, sir. Although I'm not as I wish I could write the way you do. I got to tell you, the International Bank of Bob is, it's one thing to be an actor and a voiceover guy and navigate this insane business called show, right? But it seems to me that you kind of decided, well, that's not enough. I'm going to make a huge difference in the world here, at least my difference, and I'm going to go off to places like, Egypt and Rwanda and Cambodia, and I'm going to investigate how to make the world a better place. You write about microloans. You track their success. And through this organization, I think, called Kiva. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, man. I guess what I loved about the book, not only the fact that you write so well and it's so accessible and funny and human, but what I really love is the fact that you kind of showed us in very simple terms how to make a difference, how to make a real difference. By the way, and it doesn't really cost you any money.
That's like the kind of the awesomest part. Like, this is something anybody could do. For anybody who's not familiar with it, you can support a mom-and-pop business or help them get off the ground in about 70 different countries through this really cool charity called Kiva.org. And it's micro-lending, so you're giving people financial resources, but you're lending. You're encouraging an economy. It's not just aid. So once their businesses are getting off the ground, then they pay back, and it's the most reasonable interest that people can come up with. You don't make any money on the deal, but when you get paid back, you can basically just put the money right back out there. So when the bicycle delivery guy in Nicaragua, has his new bike and he's making a better profit as a result and he pays off the loan, then you can go ahead and fund the chicken farmer in the Philippines or you know, whatever.
But you use small numbers. We're talking about $25, mm-hmm. $50. Break down, and you do it in the book, but break down how $50 makes a difference to, say, a bicycle repairman in Egypt or what have you.
It's unbelievable when you travel in a lot of the developing world. You know, Americans certainly have the experience of going to, you know, if you travel internationally and you go to some holiday vacation in Europe, all of a sudden your dollar doesn't go very far. Well, in the poorer parts of the world, a place like Rwanda, I met a woman there who changed her family's entire lives. I mean, started a whole new business and was able to build, got a new house. And the whole life changed for her and her three kids. And her initial loan in Rwandan francs was the equivalent of $140.
Wow.
It's unbelievable how much further our money goes. So that, you know, that's six $25 loans, you know, if that had been mm-hmm. financed through Kiva. And you know what? I mean, and you get paid back. That's the thing. I've been making these loans now for 4 years, and I get paid back over 99% of my capital.
Jeez. So and Kiva does all the research, so you know you're not getting ripped off. They actually do the you get the profile. You see what they look like and everything.
Yeah. I mean, like, if I hand you $100 and you hand me back $100, and in the process, like, I don't know, 75 cents hits the floor, but now you can feed your kids. I'm pretty okay with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, explain to me how she changed her life with $140 in Rwanda. And you're talking about, by the way, a country not too long ago mm-hmm. that had the most ferocious concentrated killing probably in the history of the world.
For people who may not remember the 1994 genocide, it was one of the worst things that ever happened anywhere. I mean, and that's not to slight other enormous tragedies we can all name, but it was a period of 3 months in which no one even knows, 800,000, million people, whatever. The numbers vary, but an enormous number of people were killed in this huge genocide. It was the Tutsi minority were being wiped out by the Hutu. One of the great tragedies of it is that there's actually no difference between them. It's completely invented and arbitrary. And
that's right. I think it was a Belgian construct, in fact. I mean, there was this notion that the Tutsi tend to be taller with less broad features, which is actually not true. They do look the same.
Yeah, it's basically the same folks. I mean, it's like looking at pictures in clouds, and you can kind of, you know, see a face a certain way if you want to when you're looking at clouds, but you can see what you want to. If you want to see Tutsis and Hutus, you can. But they speak the same language. They have the same traditions, the same religion. It basically, Hutu and Tutsi were just, class markers.
Yeah, and they were all married. They intermarried and everything. And
so this completely pointless, like all genocides, of course. And like the thing that comes out in the book over and over again, by the way, is you remember that Star Trek episode where Frank Gorshin's painted black on one side of his face and white on the other side,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and then he's playing another character and it's white and black on the other side,
mm-hmm.
and it was this Gene Roddenberry kind of crude, very on the nose attempt to talk about how racism is really silly and all this,
mm-hmm.
and you can see it's the same guy the whole time. And well, take that on kind of a global scale, and I'm going all over the world to, I mean, places I didn't know that I was necessarily going to be welcomed. You know, I go bouncing into Vietnam and Cambodia and, you know, Lebanon and whatever, and I don't know what's going to happen, and I don't know what to expect. And I got treated like an old friend everywhere I went. If you travel with an open heart and you just look people in the eye, take them where they are, listen, it doesn't take long. People just open up, and you start just seeing everybody in the world as just trying to make a better life for their kids.
Well, I was going to say, you just said it. Yeah, I'm sorry, Hunter, I always say, I grew up overseas my whole life, so I always say to people, you know, you may think Iraqis, you hear a lot of Americans say, well, Iraqis or certain people in parts, they don't value life and death the way we do. Let me tell you something. Yes, they do. They have the same dreams, the same hopes. They scream just as loudly when they're hurt and they're crushed just exactly the same way an American parent would if they lose their child, etc. Everybody wants a better life for their children. Everybody wants some say in who governs them. I don't care what anybody says, and I'm sure you would agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been my experience everywhere I've gone.
Mm.
So I'm in Rwanda. I meet this woman. She had she was a single mom with three kids, and about a year and a half before I met her, she was living in an unsealed, basically a shack, sleeping on, you know, the dirt floor, really no education, no real potential source of income. And but she was willing to work, and she was willing to try to be creative. And a friend of hers teaches her how to basically just go and buy staples, potatoes and corn or, you know, whatever, sorghum, and buy it in bulk, transport it back to the neighborhood, break it into smaller quantities, and sell it at a profit. Basically sort of the 7-Eleven model, you know, the convenience and then the markup. And so she started this with, I think sorghum was the first thing she did it with. And she started it doing with, you know, rice and cooking oil and other things, where she would get a tiny loan to finance buying the stuff. She'd haul her butt however many miles to the market, grab the stuff, physical labor, bring it back, but sell it. And her neighbors were more than happy to pay for the convenience of not having to haul off to market themselves, exactly the same as you know, we do here whenever we buy something conveniently. And fast forward 18 months, and it was $140 was her original stake that got her off the ground, and they've moved out of the shack. The kids have a solid roof to sleep under. They got a nice little two-room home. The front room is the business. There's a desk selling gum and razors and, you know, all the stuff you'd get at a gas station or whatever. And the back room is the home with a nice bed the kids can sleep on. They're about to start school. They're going to learn to read and they're going to learn English in school. They'll be able to speak multiple languages, and their lives will be utterly, incomprehensibly different from what they might have been.
You know, as you speak of this, there's a book called The Science of Getting Rich, written in, I think, 1900 by Wallace Wattles. It was kind of like the first self-help book. And one of the things he said that struck me, I remember so vividly in the book, is he said, "I don't believe in charity for the poor. I believe in inspiration." And that seems to me the fundamental difference between this. Kiva is not really a charity. It sounds to me like more an inspiration, something that inspires people to really gives them self-respect and gives them command over their own lives, man.
Well, I think it comes down to how do we define charity. I mean, certainly when there's been an earthquake, a disaster, you know, something like that, obviously a certain amount of aid and help and relief has got to happen. I mean, that's the thing. But if aid alone was going to, you know, transform economies, then, you know, Africa would certainly be a vastly more prosperous continent than it currently is.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, we're how many, almost 20 years after Live Aid, and Ethiopia still doesn't even have, you know, food security. They still can't even feed their own people, which has more to do with incredibly bad governance and massive corruption and a whole bunch of other things. And you can't solve those things just by throwing money at it. Now, I'm not saying that microfinance is a panacea either, but there are certain situations, and it's not everywhere, but there are situations where it actually works really well. When there is some stability, when you actually have a country where, you know, the currency is stable enough, and you have people that you know aren't in the middle of war and stuff like that, and you're above a certain level of desperation. If people are just, you know, scrambling to feed themselves, the idea of financing a business gets a little crazy.
But you know, one of the things is that it seems to me when you give you talk about this in the book, when you give somebody a microloan, they know specifically and locally, you know, so much more about their own problems than the World Bank, for example, that has a blanket sort of notion of what they need to do, like build this huge water dam or whatever, that getting through that bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was interesting. Actually, after the book was published, I was invited to go meet some folks. I had an interesting lunch at the World Bank, getting to talk to some of the people who do the really, you know, the big projects. And what's interesting, I mean, places like the World Bank, I mean, their mission, they're funded, their whole existence is built around, you know, funding really, really massive projects. And everybody over there is totally sincere. They're just trying to do the best that they can with the mission that they've been given. But, you know, a lot of times, they're learning, by the way. I want to give them credit. Everybody I talk to over there, nobody over there is you know, set in their ways. They really want to solve problems. That's why they're committed to it.
Yeah.
But, man, it's just hard because Westerners come in thinking, okay, I know that I've got my degrees and I've got my experience, and there's a whole long history of development where Westerners come in with our bold new ideas without really listening to the locals, like you were saying.
Yeah, I had a really interesting conversation with a guy who is I sat next to him on a plane, who is an executive at the Latin American Development Bank, and he said, you know, we've kind of done our job and there's really no real need for us. But try telling that to 2,400 people in Washington who rely on having a job and having this specific job, which is to give Latin American countries loans that actually at this point they don't need. And I, my buddy who was a soldier in Iraq for a long time said that you get these NGOs get judged by their burn rate. So you've got this money for this, you know, water project, and they don't need it in that particular part of the country. For example, let's say it's Afghanistan, to irrigate their crops. They don't need it. They've got something else in place. And yet, well, you gotta, because this money's been allocated for this project.
And if you don't use it, then it won't be there next year.
And all, yeah. And also, I'm rated by my burn rate. I'm rated by what I build, and that those are the problems with these large bureaucratic. These are good people and well-intentioned people, but like anything that gets too big, too bureaucratic, with too many layers, it seems that Kiva is a panacea, at least in the alternate, the antidote to that.
Well, I mean, one thing that Kiva does and the microfinance does, and this was pioneered by Muhammad Yunus and by some folks in Latin America, you know, it's very intensely focused on just listening to the local people. What do you need? And they know their problems. They're, you know, poor people are plenty smart. In fact, there's a magnificent book called The Portfolios of the Poor, which was written by some academics who went out in the field and spent time chronicling the financial transactions of people in, I think it was three or four different countries. It's been a couple of years since I read the book. Where they were actually keeping very close diaries on the financial activities of people who were getting by on like $2 a day. And their lives, their financial lives, are every bit as complex and carefully planned as anything you and I would ever come up
Perhaps even more planned because they have so few resources.
Every penny is accounted for, and they know where it's all going, and it's all planned. And there are, even in, you know, some of the densest slums that you'll find, there are analogs to what we would think of as savings accounts, checking accounts, credit, all of the different sort of financial instruments that we have. The poor do too. They're already pretty sophisticated about this stuff. So this is much more about going to them and saying, okay, well, what would you do if you had? What's a business that would work for you where you are right now if you had $100 or $200 or $400, which is the average size of a Kiva loan?
Yeah, well, you brought up Muhammad Yunus, right, who really started microfinance and actually won the Nobel Peace Prize with Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. I think it's worth, just so that people really understand why it was created, to understand, like, what problem was he trying to solve, right? Which is, and Brian's giving me the thumbs up.
Well, that was my question. I was going to say, take us through, because the Muhammad Yunus story is very inspirational, because this guy was living in, or at least I think visiting his home country, Bangladesh, which was the poorest country in the world. I think he saw a guy throw up and another guy ate it. I mean, that's how poor they were, how hungry they were, something terrible like that. But those most of these people that do something to solve a major problem are reacting to a tragedy or something they just can't take anymore. Can you tell us a little bit about Muhammad Yunus? I just hijacked Hunter's question.
We're one mind, hive mind, Brian.
I'm like giving you the thumbs up, like across, like, hey, like, what is that? Hey, dude, great question. I was going to ask it too. Like, I want credit too. Oh God. All right.
Yunus is, I mean, the classic part of the tale that I think is really instructive is he was a professor at the University of Chittagong.
Chittagong, sure, yeah.
Which was also a Disney film,
yeah,
right?
Great football
Chitty
program.
Chitty Gong Gong.
Great football program.
They're awesome. The Chittagong Rams, you don't want to miss those guys.
Yeah.
So he's, it's actually, I haven't been, I've got an invite. I'd love to go. Anyway, so he went to a village not far out of the city and met a bunch of women who were making really beautiful furniture by hand, woodworkers. And, I mean, they had a great work ethic. They were building great stuff. They were selling all of it. They were marketing it really well. And they were freaking poor. And he was like, well, what's the deal? You're all like, you know, what's happening here? And the problem was that the only, you know, if you're poor in Bangladesh and you've got a nice business but you're a little bit behind or you need to repair your equipment, you can't walk into Citibank and ask for a bridge loan. the only finance that's available to them is black market, where they've got to pay an interest rate of, you know, 70%, 100%.
Loan sharking,
Yeah. And so they were actually just getting crushed by servicing their debt to the black market.
Mm-hmm.
So Eunice reaches into his pocket, and he pulls out the equivalent of about $27 U.S., and he hands it to him and basically helps them get out of poverty himself. And that was enough for, I forget how many women it was, but it was like 40 women or something, who were able to work their way out of poverty by breaking the debt cycle.
It's mm-hmm. almost like a strip club, but like way more noble. I mean, I've helped a lot of girls with their nursing degrees, but it cost me so much more than that, dude.
You've been a microfinancier for so much longer than you realize.
I know. It's terrible. God, those ungrateful chicks.
But, well, you know, they hadn't been vetted by Kiva.
they had not been vetted by Kiva.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. Don't go to strip clubs that have been approved by
Kiva.
I can't find them. Yeah. Spearman Rhino is not vetted.
It's a real high priority right now. So anyway, exactly. That wound up working well enough that the Grameen Bank, which is that in the local language just means people's bank, village bank, I should say, it grew exponentially from there, and has fundamentally changed not just the living circumstances for God only knows how many tens of millions of Bangladeshis, but it's actually fundamentally changed the culture. When this is how powerful and important this stuff is, because it makes the world safer. It makes the world better for everybody. Compare Bangladesh and Pakistan right now. Now, when Eunice does this in the 1970s, Bangladesh has just gone through a horrific famine in the wake of a terrible cyclone. And, you know, that's the country that George Harrison was organizing concerts for, and this is just a few years later. And so they were behind Pakistan. They'd been part of the same country for a while and fought a horrible war against Pakistan for their independence that contained its own genocidal behavior. So Bangladesh was as far on its knees as a country could possibly be. Compare them today, and it's not just Eunice, but my goodness, Grameen Bank is a huge fundamental part of this. And compare the level of development in and safety and the treatment of women and the level of security, the way, you know, everything around Bangladesh and around Pakistan right now. Look at the two countries, and you've got like almost a lab experiment. You've got to control Pakistan. This is what would have happened maybe if Bangladesh doesn't have this, you know, wonderful organization. And today, women in Bangladesh, I mean, it's still not, you know, what we would consider by Western standards necessarily the greatest place for women's rights, but it is just a quantum level ahead of some of the stuff you hear happening in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe to my core that that's fundamentally related to people having to women being empowered by the loans, because the loans from the Grameen Bank are made to women. It puts women in charge of the financial resources. And so it transformed the culture. It completely transformed the culture.
Yeah, it gives you self-respect, this idea that you are rewarded for your risk, for your ingenuity. The things that we take for granted in this country are so, you know, that should be a human right, man. That really is. I mean, you're talking about a free market, a place where people are able to actually, you know, be rewarded for their blood, sweat, and tears. And it's amazing how the world, I mean, look at Latin America. Latin America now is, they are maybe imperfect democracies, but they are democracies. I really think the world is a better place by far than it was, for example, in the 70s. I know it is.
Oh, my God, yeah. Well, that's one of the things that I write about in this book and also in Who Hates Whom and somewhat in Prisoner to Pakistan, not to plug my entire back.
Hey, listen, dude, we're going to read them all, and I'm going to have you back on after I read The Prisoner of Trebekistan.
I'd love to.
Oh, we need, Bob, we need to time out for a sec because we're having a technical issue?
Yeah, we need to pause and, like...
What happened?
For some reason, I think I just need to restart everything again.
Okay.
Because I'm picking up your levels in his track.
Oh, okay, so she's picking up my level. How long has that been going on?
A couple of minutes.
Oh, just a couple minutes. All right, well, we'll back up, Bob. No big deal.
No problem.
So let's just pause for a second.
Yeah. Make a difference. I mean, that's what I find so inspiring. No matter where I am, I travel so much especially around the country. And it's amazing how we are becoming of one mind. I mean, people are, most people are interested in the truth of what's going on. They, they want to know things. Even
rather
people
than
who,
some partisan agenda.
Yeah, and I bet the majority have not been to college. But the majority of young men that I talk to come up to me after my shows that they just are they want to learn, and this is a forum for them to learn. That's one of the things I've noticed. So it's kind of cool.
Okay, guys.
You know, I'm the Muhammad Yunus of
podcasting.
Podcasting.
Reach into your pocket, you pull out 27 ideas.
That's exactly that's right, brother. Are we back?
We are back.
Compared to after this book, I can never feel ungrateful for anything ever again as long as I live.
Well, I want to talk to you about that too, because that's the perspective that I want to impart to people. I was thinking about that as I read the book, and especially just the, like in Egypt, you're sweating through your shirt, or it's Morocco, you're sweating
Morocco,
through your
yeah.
shirt. You're not even in the tourist area, or you're in a place that's not even on the tourist map, and it's just, you know, these guys are all behind you, and their hands are all, you're doing the fist bump, and you're doing all this stuff. It's I've had those experiences, you know, just growing up in the countries I did. And I was born in the Philippines. I lived in India, Pakistan, Greece, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon. Yeah, I moved to the States when I was 14. And in the process, I traveled to Yemen and everywhere. I mean, I went to communist China. I went to Russia. I went everywhere. I went all over Africa. I saw, as a kid, I saw terrible poverty. I saw people with leprosy. I saw people with malaria. I remember the guy who worked at our compound was under blankets, shivering and from malaria. And I never forgot that. And what it did for me was I said, why am I so lucky, man? Mm-hmm. I'm a white kid living in air conditioning, and I've never been hungry in my life. And my mother's keeping the woman at the end of the block alive with porridge every day. This doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Why'd the math fall in my favor?
We should talk about the birth lottery, because you do such a good job of laying that out. And I grew up as well all over the world. And, you know, we do have an aristocracy that still exists today, and it's the aristocracy of citizenship.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Yeah, just where you happen to be born. I mean, as much envy as I can feel when I watch that royal birth thing. Or not envy, it's just kind of this, like, dudes, we fought a revolution against this.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, yeah, man. Wow, that's a great point.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't the whole point of the United States?
Didn't George Washington say, I will not accept your kingship and walk away?
Yeah. So, like, you know, okay, well, that was a couple hundred years ago. What the hell?
Yeah.
We'll just give ourselves over completely. Just, you know.
There's a fascination with celebrity and with the, you know, with all that stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
yeah.
really what it is, I think.
Yeah. I can look up to that, and I can feel like, oh, man, that's so undeserved. And then I can look at my own life and compare it to a bunch of places I've been, and it's, oh, man, that's so undeserved. So.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's right.
Yeah.
Should we good, Rena?
Yeah.
All right, let's rock and roll. Let's go back. Let's go back for a second, Bob. I want to talk about, you know, Muhammad Yunus, because you use the two examples of Pakistan and Sri Lanka and how microloans have fundamentally changed not only the country but the culture itself in Sri Lanka, and how far ahead in things like women's rights Sri Lanka is.
Bangladesh.
I'm sorry, Bangladesh. I always confuse the two, Bangladesh, and how different they are, and how so much of it you are convinced has to do with, you know, Muhammad Yunus. And I wanted to talk about the fact that the guy reaches into his pocket, he pulls out $27, he gives it to these women making furniture. And you could make an argument that that action of reaching into his pocket, that decision he made to reach into his pocket and pull out $27 and give it to those women, actually changed the world.
Yeah, well, and it changed him, and then he went out and changed.
Yeah, I mean, think about the butterfly effect,
yeah.
you know, that had. That's incredible to me.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happens when people go to Kiva, actually. If you go to the website, kiva.org, big plug, we'll just link over there, and it's like looking at eBay, but for doing good. Rather than stuff that people are pulling out of their garages, it's, you know, people who are building their lives, and you see pictures, and you see biographies of the people. And the first time that you actually sit there and you read it, and you say, yeah, okay, you know what, I'm going to make a loan. I can do this. I got $25. I'll skip Starbucks for a week, whatever. Then there is a little change in there. It's like you're pushing yourself. But the thing is, it's different from conventional charity, because conventional charity is so much about need and, like, guilt and the image of Sally Struthers, the weepy-eyed, and you're just sitting at home going, fine, fine, I'll give you $5. Just get off my TV. I want to watch the game.
That's right.
You know, and charity feels funky a lot. And this isn't about that. This is a completely different set of emotions. This is about people who are, you know, trying to take power over their lives, people who are trying to build something. And so these are people who know what they need. You're just kind of helping them out on the way. But
well, that's the difference. Is like charity is not funky. Charity is embarrassing for both me, for both the giver and the givee, for the receiver and the giver. I mean, that's the problem. It's an embarrassing thing for people to have to take money. It's an embarrassing thing for somebody to give, hey, here you go, here's some money. It's for both parties, it's very uncomfortable for both parties. And sometimes, like you said, it's necessary. But Kiva, the loan is different because they're paying it back, and by the way, they're taking control of their lives and actually applying it to something that they are trying to get off the ground or whatever.
And working towards independence.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the point.
Yeah.
You break the cycle of dependency.
Yeah, so and I was curious, there have been controversies about microfinance and stuff, and I just wanted to know whether this worked or not. And by the way, you're talking about the butterfly effect. So the way this whole book started is all butterfly effect, and it shows the power of one person doing one nice thing, and it wasn't me. totally true. I lucked into a job as a luxury travel writer, so this is, by a lot of measures, possibly the greatest job a human being can possibly have.
Right. You took a $7,000 shot, didn't you, or something like that?
Oh, well, I didn't actually touch it. I didn't have that big of a
budget.
A stipend, yeah.
But I mean, I saw that it's insane things that were going on with billion-dollar wealth in different places around the world. And when I got to Dubai, I stayed one night, two nights, in the Emirates Palace, which is a $3 billion hotel, where they go through 11 pounds of gold. So that's, what, $500,000 in gold or something like that, $300,000, $400,000 worth of gold every year, just in pastry decorations.
What? What? What are you talking about? What?
Yeah.
Hold on. They go through how many pounds?
11 pounds, 5 kilos.
5 kilos of gold just shaving it on their pastries?
Yeah.
Somebody ought to drop a bomb on that place. Are you kidding me? Yeah. That is awesome.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Well, the guy's bragging about it to me. He's like, you know, they have this one package that they offer to couples. It's a romantic weekend that only costs $1 million.
It costs $1 million? What do you get for $1 million? Other chicks? Come on, man.
I can tell you're a comic.
Yeah.
That's the road experience right there. That's the first place. That's where you went to.
Well, listen.
I was a stand-up on the road for like 6 years in the late 80s and early 90s.
So you know exactly what I'm talking about.
That's where my head goes, too. I'm doing all this, and then right outside, I'm in Dubai, and I step out the hotel, and there's the guys who are building the next monstrosities next door. And there are all these workers who are just the same way that rich is fantastically more rich there. These guys were fantastically less rich. And they're working 12 hours a day in 105, 110 degree heat. And it's humid, too. The heat index is like 120, 130. Just crazy heat. Just hits you in the face there. And, well, you've been to Yemen, you know.
Yeah.
So. And they're working like 12 hours a day, and they're staying, you know, 10 to a head in labor camps out in the desert. And these guys are from South India, they're from Nepal, they're from Southeast Asia, East Africa, and they're making $6 a day.
And by the way, having lived in Saudi Arabia and spending time in the summer there, people don't realize how hot it really is. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's like make Vegas on its hottest day.
Yep.
As humid as the Midwest.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
It's insane. Yeah. And how people function or even thought to live there for any reason, I can't even imagine.
I know.
So these guys are just wilting right in front of me. And in fact, there are heat-related fatalities are actually really quite common in a lot of the Gulf states. So these guys some of them are actually literally being worked to death. And how people like me go as tourists and just walk past it, I don't know. But my dad worked at General Motors. I remember seeing him being really freaking tired. And that was the only mental map I had. And I learned that some of these guys, eventually I found out that they're there for their families. That $6 a day is a lot of money when you're from Nepal.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can send some of it home. And so they're going through this hell because they love their kids.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm supposed to take all this money from being a luxury travel writer and just put it in my pocket and go home and say, well, that was fun, and then how do I wake up with a soul the next day?
So, you're a good man.
I left something in customs. Yeah. I can't remember what it was. Oh, it was my soul.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, so I didn't know what to do at first. I had no idea, and it was more to make myself feel better probably than for any practical reason, but I raided my mini bar one night. In the Fairmont Hotel, I went down to Sheikh Zayed Road and sat down with these four guys. And they were, I guess they'd missed their bus. I don't really know. We didn't have much language in common. But I just kind of sat there with them. I wanted to find a way to cross a divide or whatever. And nothing much happened. It wasn't memorable for them, I'm sure. It was memorable for me because that was when it was really churning for me that I wanted to do something. And the butterfly effect moment was when I was walking up to them. Now, keep in mind that after this and having this whole issue, I then went on to spend 4 years researching this book and traveling all over the world and writing doing all this stuff and the $3.5 million on the lending team at Kiva and all these things happened. I'm walking up to the guy, these four guys, and one of them looks up at me and nods and gives me a little smile and made me feel welcome. Without that nod and that one little smile, if he'd sneered at me in that one moment, literally one facial expression on one other human being, a greeting of welcome, a moment of common humanity, the last 4 years of my entire life and everyone that I've touched in those 4 years would have been completely different.
That's so amazing. That's so amazing. You're there's a book called The Bridge. It was a documentary called The Bridge, but there was an article in The New Yorker. A woman who jumped off the bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, wrote a note saying, "If one person smiles at me on the way to the bridge, I won't jump."
Oh God!
And she did jump. I love those stories. I love that, man. Isn't that funny? How, jeez, it's incredible how one tiny gesture of kindness can actually change. That guy had no idea that by looking at you and giving you a little smile that a whole bunch of people's lives in countries he'll never go to and people he'll never meet just got better.
Yeah, and the thing is, he wouldn't even remember it because. To him, I'm sure I was just the weird foreigner who sat with him for a little while. He couldn't pick me out of a police lineup at this point,
right.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Right.
So for anybody listening to this, we have no way of knowing, but it's everybody's as sensitive as we are, and anybody who's listening to this. So you, whoever you are listening to this at your laptop or whatever, almost certainly have done something similar. You've smiled at somebody. You've just been kind to a cashier. You've been friendly to the waiter, whatever. And God knows what our ripple effects are on each other, but they're so vastly greater than we ever realize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's just kind of cool. Even when I have a really crap day, I know that if I go out and I'm, if I'm smiling and friendly to people and, hey, who knows? Something good will happen to somebody else. Whatever.
I wish I knew a song. I wish I could just break into some awesome some awesome Springsteen ballad. Like, I come down in the valley. But it's so true, man. I mean, it's so true. It's such an inspiring way to look at things, and I choose to live in that kind of world. I think that's the way to do it. I was saying the other day to somebody younger, I was always criticized for, worrying about people too much. I do people favors and things like that. Well, you're not focusing on yourself enough. I did an inventory of all the favors I've done. I've gotten paid back about 1,000-fold, not only just in how I feel and just friendships, but also in a lot of other ways. I mean,
yeah,
yes, you know.
True.
And I don't care anyway. I mean, you do it because it's called common decency. You do it because it's the thing to do. You do it because you can. I mean, the whole point of this podcast that Hunter and I always talk about is, we had a long talk the other day. What's the objective? Well, the objective is really just to kind of feel like we're inspiring people and teaching younger people and showing them that there are people out there like you that they can read about and be inspired by and learn from. And so it goes, man. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to make the world a better place.
We're all trying. This is one thing we can do. It's like they set the you light one candle,
yeah.
And man, if everybody's doing it, it gets real bright.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think that's what the value of the internet. I mean, I think that is happening to an extent.
That's the other thing. We were talking about the world, getting more peaceful. You were talking about that before. Maybe things are better now than they were before. I gotta tell you, I've been around the world three times, traveled extensively other than that. And I have to say, if you actually, as crappy as things look a lot of the time, because we turn on the TV news and we see, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan and things blowing up, and the rest of the world looks like this really noisy place. And the truth of it is that it's getting more peaceful at, by historical standards, light speed. I mean,
without question, without question.
Well, and that's the subject of Steven Pinker's latest book, right? Yeah. He basically, The Better Angels of Our Nature, he goes into, like, the fact is that, you know, violent death is decreasing across history.
Yeah. Mm. Absolutely, because we start seeing it as communications increase, we're able to see each other as each other, and it's so similar to ourselves.
Mm.
And I don't think I'll live to see it in my lifetime, and Lord knows we may destroy the planet, you know, in the meantime too. But I think we're, if things fall right, I think we're only a few generations away from a society where people realize that things like ethnicity and your language and, you know, even religions and all this stuff, it's about as thin as a coat of paint, and you scratch it off, and underneath there's people just trying to get by.
Well, I'll do you one better. If you read Ray Kurzweil's book, Ray Kurzweil said, is as we learn to tap into our own brains and download information, you're going to be able to have virtual experiences and feel what it's like to be someone else, because you can tap into their sort of their mental unit at the time, you know, their neural net, and actually have experiences of, he goes into detail describing how that's possible, kind of like sharing an interface with a computer. We'll be able to do that with each other's brains, which is crazy.
Strip clubs get really interesting.
Now I get to see what it's like to dance on me.
Dude, you know?
And that's what I'm talking about. But you're such a complicated guy. You're such an interesting guy. I mean, here you are. You write these books. You go all over the world. You make the world a better place. You're an actor. You're a stand-up comic. You're a voiceover artist. Oh, and by the way, you won Jeopardy. How in the world? I never answer any of those questions properly. How do you get that good at trivia?
Oh, honestly... you know, I think most people playing at home get at least half of them, I'm sure. No, they don't.
I'm not giving that to you. We get about three or four of them. I'm most people at home, my friend.
Who is Abraham Lincoln?
Yeah, that's right. That's
right. Well, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, the book Prisoner of Trebekistan actually gets into. I mean, I went on the show. I was broke and I was living in L.A. and they were handing out money down the street for having a brain full of crap, and I said, okay. And so I went and tried out for the show a bunch of times. And my degree is in electrical engineering, so I don't know any of that liberal arts stuff that they have on the show.
Right.
I had never read any Shakespeare, really, except a couple things in high school. I really didn't know anything on the Jeopardy syllabus.
Right.
But there are ways to play the game that I was able to figure out. And I kept taking the test until after failing five times, I finally passed it. And they called me for the show, and I had like 3 weeks to suddenly give myself a complete liberal arts education, because I also don't like being humiliated on national television.
Yeah, I can understand. I played pool boy on Mad TV. I was in a Speedo. I was in a Speedo with a blonde wig and high-heeled sneakers. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Honestly, I think I was so unprepared, I think I would have considered pool boy a step up. But there are mnemonic techniques that you can use to shove information into your head. And there are ways to read the Jeopardy clues and kind of get what the writers are looking at in ways that maybe you wouldn't at first glance. And then there's just kind of a creative stuff that I learned doing improv in Chicago in the 80s that is really helpful for figuring out the clues. Just things like thinking laterally.
Wow.
So, like, I can give you an example of the kind of thing that I honestly truly believe that anybody could do, and that I was lucky enough to get to do on the show. There was a Final Jeopardy answer. It was in some Tournament of Champions, in 1998 Tournament of Champions, and the category was English literature, and I had to get the Final Jeopardy to continue, and I'm playing against a woman who's a librarian.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
So she's got this little smile on her face.
Oh, God.
And we're really good friends now. But, yeah. And the question was, and I swear to you, I didn't have a clue, the fifth edition of this work, published in 1676, included an addendum on fly fishing by Charles Cotton. 30 seconds, players.
Oh, no. What are you talking about?
Yeah, and I was like, what the? Oh, God. All right, well, hang in, hold on. And here's how I got the answer to that. I answered it correctly. Okay. Now, there's a clue in here. There's some sort of hint. The writers aren't trying to screw us. All right. Fifth edition of this work. So I start thinking off of fifth edition. And all I can think of is New Edition, the little band.
Yeah.
No, that's not where they're going. Okay, British literature. This was 1676, and I flashed to the movie 1776, and I've got Ben Franklin dancing around. I'm thinking, that's not British literature. Okay. The next thing is Addendum on Fly Fishing by Charles Scott. Okay, that's got to be the hint.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, really old book, got a fish in it. Find it. And I go, oh, Moby Dick! And then I realize you can't fly fish Moby Dick.
Right.
So I'm totally lost.
That's where Ahab went wrong.
I'm just thinking about A River Runs Through It. That's the only fly fishing book I ever read.
So what I start doing then is, I can't even think of another book. So I start free associating off of the word fishing. Rods, reels, hip waders, angling, ice fishing, wait, angling. Oh, crap, there's a really old book called The Complete Angler.
Oh,
and it's spelled funny, so it must be really old. Okay, I'll write that down. And
wow.
That was the correct answer.
Wow.
Now, the folks at home thought, wow, that guy knows his British literature. But no. So I played Jeopardy many times against people far better educated, far more. They've actually read all the books whose titles I've merely memorized.
Amazing. Mm-hmm.
And often won because it's that kind of thinking during the clues and during the play. And that's all sort of outlined in the book, and there's a bunch of stuff about how to learn things. And
how do you learn? I mean, Hunter's great at this. Hunter speaks a number of languages. He wrote a great book called The Straight A Conspiracy, basically about the taking on the notion that people are born smart. He hates that idea. He thinks it's a very destructive idea because how you learn is really relies on the emotional context in which you approach something.
Yes.
And Hunter's very articulate about that, but way more than I could be. But Hunter learns. I talked to Hunter. He knows a bunch of languages, probably about nine. And I said to Hunter, "How in the world are you? What do you learn now?" He goes, "Well, now I'm learning groups. I'm learning sort of the master languages. I'm learning sort of, you know, what did you say? How are you?
Language families.
You're learning language families now. Okay, so he's learning, the Scandinavian languages, and then the." I was whatever.
But it's essentially, it's what you're talking about. The point is that, listen, if you have isolated information is really hard to remember for humans. Humans are really good at memorizing things that are connected and related to things mm-hmm. that we already know, mm-hmm. right? So the thing is that, in fact, if you look at, you know, Norwegian, Swedish, Danish, these languages are incredibly similar, right? So the extra work that it takes once you, if you're going to put in the work to learning Swedish or whatever, the extra work to learn Norwegian mm-hmm. or Danish is tiny because it's just a tiny variation on it. And the thing is that by learning that variation, rather than it being this random piece of information, it's now connected to mm-hmm. something,
yeah,
right?
Like Latin languages, French,
yeah,
Spanish,
exactly.
Italian. You buy two, you get the third one free.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly.
Absolutely. It's the same way with memorizing stuff that I was loading in for Jeopardy. But since I didn't have stuff to connect it to already,
mm-hmm.
A couple of different approaches. The main thing is that the glue your brain uses is actually really intense emotional experiences,
mm-hmm.
visceral responses to things, survival issues, bathroom issues, sexual issues, anything like that. Any stuff. That's why, you know, when people get drunk, they can only remember dirty jokes because that's the stuff that's glued in best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so wow. I basically memorized most of Shakespeare with smut.
Mm-hmm.
People knew the stuff that was flying through my head when I'm trying to remember things. I mean, there's a lot of like X-rated crap in my
very
head.
Bawdy,
violent stuff.
Yeah.
And but like for example, I wanted to memorize the locations of the major Native American nations before Columbus came over, and where they roughly were around the country. And I was familiar with a lot of the names roughly, but I didn't really know where they were in case it came up. And that would normally be a really difficult task, but you're talking about hanging things on existing stuff in your head? Well, I don't know, already, I was a road comic, so I know the geography of the United States pretty well. I've driven the interstate highway map, you know, plenty of times. So, okay, let me just link the tribes to something where they were, like something in the present day. And so the Chickasaw Indians were in the area around Memphis. Okay, Chickasaw, what's in Memphis? Elvis slept with every chick he saw. Okay.
Amazing.
You will now remember that for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I will. I sure as heck will. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's how everything...
Cool.
I'm working to learn things, I'm actually looking for the whatever kind of jokey,
mm-hmm.
sexual or violent or whatever connection I can make that's really primal. And then your brain just allocates the space without any effort. I mean, you learned that Chickasaw Memphis thing for the rest of your life with no effort whatsoever.
Yeah.
if you can learn to do that as a habit, as you're storing the information, then all of a sudden a lot of stuff just sticks.
Well, and that's the tragic joke of all of this sort of stuff is, you know, I mean, one of the things we talk about in the book is basically there are four memorization techniques that you have, right?
Mm-hmm.
And repetition, the one that every student is taught to use, is the least effective. Like,
yeah.
You know, what you're talking, I mean, you know, logic is the third most effective, right? If things make sense, right?
Uh-huh.
If there's some sort of rationale, right? Then that's number three. Number two is emotion, right?
Uh-huh.
Everybody remembers where they were when 9/11 happened,
right?
Because it's like such an emotionally impactful event, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the first is story, which is really what happens when you hook up emotion and logic together.
Mm-hmm.
You have a series of events that are connected in a logical fashion, and there's emotion going on, which is why, P.S., for 10,000 years, our ancestors communicated information from generation to generation, not via flashcards, but via stories.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I think that's the thing. Really, what this is all about, it's about using the human mind in the way that the human mind is good at doing, as opposed to trying to get it to work like a computer, because
yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Not.
Absolutely. Wow, you've said that either really eloquently off the top of your head.
He did. Hunter's very smart.
But I've also...
Well, that's why he's on the Brian Callen show, so I can take all kinds of credit for his brain. It's like, whoa, who's this Hunter guy? People keep coming to me on the road like, who's this new Hunter guy? He makes your podcast awesome. I'm like, yeah, he's the one who chooses the guests. He's smarter than I am by far. It's great. So, well, let me put you both on the spot for a second.
Okay.
I have a lot of people come up to me, young people, say, what should I read? You know, I want to educate myself. If I give you a year to give people, what is, maybe start with you, Bob, what's the best way to get, I give you a year, you take somebody who's a blank slate, or at least somebody who doesn't learn much, wants to learn. What would you do? What are the books you would read? Who are the people you would study? Where do we start if we're talking about a liberal arts education?
Well, if it's me, first thing I do is... And I think we should do this in our schools, is, you know, we give our kids books and tell them to learn stuff, and that's very much like handing a medical student a knife and saying, go do surgery. I think the first thing we should do is teach kids how to learn instead of what to learn.
Yep.
And that should be a course that's, you know, part of core curriculum throughout our entire educational system, and you keep updating and refreshing the techniques as the kids move through the system. It should be as common as math, you know, how to learn. And there's a couple of books about that anybody can Google and find on.
Great one on it is The Art of Learning by Josh Waitzkin, which I loved. Yeah. What were you going to suggest? What books?
Hard question, ain't it?
Yeah.
I would recommend a book called The Straight A Conspiracy. But, you know,
there it is,
right,
by Hunter Mott, as would I. No, but go on. So How to Learn, that's a very interesting. Yeah, that's right.
The second book I'd recommend is, it's mentioned the International Bank of Bob. It's a book about happiness where a guy took a really empirical approach to it. It's a writer named Mihaly
Csikszentmihalyi.
Yes, that's the Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. That's exactly it. And I have a mnemonic for that in the book, which I forgot now. So, clearly full of crap. It's a book called Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience.
Great book.
And the guy just went around and met people and said, okay, when were you happy? Tell me about it. And took a very kind of empirical approach to it and found that happiness isn't a state exactly. It's where we are when we're working toward a goal that we really value, and we sort of have to work our way toward it. And if you think about it, all of our games are amusements. You know, I've got a football game on the TV with the volume down right now, and Canadian football, because I am that bad of a sportsman. You know, honest to God, BC's playing Toronto right now, and it's 0-0. So, anyway.
Who's your team, by the way?
Edmonton in the CFL.
Okay. Oh, in the CFL.
CFL.
Oh, my God. How about the NFL?
NFL, dude, I grew up in Cleveland. I'm ashamed to tell you I even bother to watch the game.
Poor man. poor man.
Being a Cleveland sports fan is...
Yeah.
It's a little bit like being an abused
I know.
Spouse, but it's probably easier to get out of that relationship.
That's it. He still hasn't recovered from LeBron's departure.
Yeah. Anyway, so our games. I mean, we create flow by saying, you put on the blue hat, I'll put on the red hat, I'll go this way, you go that way. Here are the boundaries. Here's the clock, so we have space and time set up for us. Here's our rules, and we can quibble over those. We can get angry about that. But now we'll have flow for 3 hours. Yay! And... it's how we design all of our games. It's actually almost, and everybody all over the world does. The games are different, but they're fundamentally identical compared to the sort of model that Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, writes in the book Flow. I highly recommend it.
Wow. Great. Awesome. Hunter, what do you have to say?
Ditto. But yeah, I mean, the most important thing is teaching people how to learn. That's the biggest thing. I mean, because, and you know, the big paradigm shift is that most people think that education is about putting knowledge into a person's head. It's not. I mean, if you look at the root of the word education, right? E means out and duco means to lead. You're leading it out of the person, right? And that's really the point is the way that most people teach is essentially tyrannical. You're trying to impose knowledge on a person rather than getting the person to like think outwards and engage and try and break down and understand the world, right? Why do we have capitalism? Why does it produce benefits? How do you maximize those benefits? Things like that. But so, yeah, essentially the thing that I would do is the whole year would be about teaching the person how to learn. But then along the way, you're using material to help people learn things. Right. So essentially, if you think of it, the mind is like a knife. Right. And the book or whatever it is just the whetstone against which you sharpen that knife.
I feel like I have a grasshopper in my hand now.
Crush it and you will be free.
You see what happens? Yeah. You learn things too on the Brian Callen Show, Bob.
Dude, I want to like go rake some sand and move some rocks.
Do it. Do it, dude. Do it, dude.
And like I'm like totally tuned now. This is great.
But then you'll realize there is no sand.
Wait a minute. Bob, you live in LA and we got to grab a beer. I'm going to get your your number and I appreciate you doing the show, man. We're out of time. We try to keep this to an hour and I could talk to you for, you know, hours. But there need to be more people like you, my friend, and the book is The International Bank of Bob. That's just the one book that we're talking about, and we're going to also put The Prisoner of Trebekistan, which I've not yet read, but I'm sure is just as good, on the website, and push it through. So just remember, guys, go to Amazon through the website and download or buy these books because they're worth it. And you'll learn something and make the world a better place, or at least learn how to. Bob Harris, you're a scholar and a gentleman.
And you are a warrior poet, my
friend. That's what I like to hear, my friend. Let me just take my shirt off when you say that.
Freedom!
Freedom! All right, my friend. Listen, I'm going to get your number from Hunter, if that's okay. And I really let's grab a beer. Where do you live? Whereabouts in L.A. do you live?
As far as something going up on the internet, I live
exactly
west of Phoenix.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to say, don't get too specific. All right, pal. We'll talk later. You're the best. Thanks so much, man.
All right, thank you, man. Thanks both of you. I really, really appreciate this. It was great.
Take care, Bob. Thank you very much.
We'll have you back soon. Later. Well done, Hunter Motz. Hunter Motz for booking another awesome guest on the Brian Callen Show. that was great, dude.
Yeah, he's awesome, right?
Yeah.
Great topic, great author.
Yeah, I had a great time. He's a great guy. All right, man. Well,
and he will forever be a voice in your head, very quietly.
Oh, I think you're still being recorded, my friend. Hold on. It's okay.
Well, anyway, I mean,
I'll call him.
Yeah. Right. Bob, here, I'm gonna give your email to Brian, and that way he can reach out.
And
to
give
you.
Him my give him a number too.
And I'll give you his number too.
No, he's disconnected.
Oh. Okay. Well.
Oh, just give him my number.
Do you yeah, for sure.
Close out the show, though, or is that,
yeah,
is that...
let's close it out. Okay. All right, guys, that was the Bob Harris, and as usual, I'm joined by my partner in crime, Hunter Motz. I thought to myself, I think you're going to have a show called The Motz Factor one day.
Well, why not, right? Like, and it'll be sponsored by the applesauce,
no,
right?
No, sponsored by me. I'm going to be rich as shit. Sponsored by Brian the Kid Callen.
Owner of
what does
everything.
That mean? What are you? What is he selling? Me, my lifestyle. Want to be like Brian? Here's a package of
his
exercise
package.
Equipment, condoms. I'm kidding. I'm married. All right. Thank you, America. Thank you. Bye bye.
You've been listening to the Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.